This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
To be invited to give the keynote at the 25th anniversary of UC San Diego's Department of Ethnic Studies means that I need to talk about something related to that. I had no intention. And so I have no intention of just coming here and giving a talk that I've given before. So I came up with a title and a set of ideas and sort of shelved it. And on the train down, I'm like, okay, now how can I make sense of this? So think of this as really unfinished, really uneven, but a real commitment to the 25, now 26 years of struggle that has produced this amazing department that's drawn both amazing faculty and students. So I'm going to struggle on this question, and let me just begin. So what I want to do is kind of situate the origins of the Department of Ethnic Studies within a particular political and historical context. I'm not going to talk about curriculum. I'm not going to talk so much about epistemologies or ideas as much as politics and contextual questions. So think about the period, you know, 1990. I mean, you know, the department was formed amidst a wave of anti-racist student protests, prison expansion. Oh, God, I can't see. Okay, that does not gonna work. Neoliberal free trade policies, you know, which eventually, you know, I mean, even before NAFTA, there's a whole series of free trade policies. Prop 187, policies that accelerated class and racial inequality, racist and anti-feminist backlash, the defeat of the Rainbow Coalition and left internationalist politics in the 1980s, which I'm gonna talk a little bit about. And although this was the period of the culture wars, and it's weird for me to think about it because in 1990, the year the department was formed, was also the year my first book came out, the year my daughter was born, who is now a PhD student at Columbia University in English, hooray. And so it was. So I lived this period. I mean, I lived through what was going on. And it's a strange thing to talk about it and to recognize some of the personalities and know that, you know, I was in touch with folks and watching this as it goes along. So in any case, this was a period that we know of as the period of the culture wars, the right-wing resistance to political correctness. But it was also marked, I think, by the hegemony of liberal multiculturalism and the proliferation of ethnic studies programs and classes. And these two things coincide with one another. They're not always in opposition. So for want of a better term, I'm calling this period or this, you know, sort of second wave ethnic studies. I'm not suggesting that there's such a sort of unified thing as second wave ethnic studies. I could share a similar ideology. In fact, ideologies are very divergent, objectives divergent. But what I'm especially interested in is the insurgent movements that shape the programs and departments that emerge in really from the late 1980s to about 1994 or so, roughly that period of time. And that produce insurgent units. And what I want to suggest here, without telling you the whole history, that UC San Diego had a uniquely insurgent ethnic studies department against many departments and programs that were not necessarily insurgent in that sense. I'm going to talk about what I mean by that in a second. Anyway, second wave ethnic studies emerged in the context of and sometimes in response to the neoliberal turn. And it often reflected efforts, real genuine efforts at multiracial coalition building, you know, and rethinking identity politics in the 60s. And I'll talk about that, but it's important to make a distinction between simply doing comparative ethnicity and saying our job is to build coalitional movements to be able to tear down the forms of oppression that we're facing. Now, two recent events have kind of shaped my remarks. One, of course, if you're following this, the recent hunger strike to defend the College of Ethnic Studies at San Francisco State University, waged by the current Third World Liberation Front, 2016 in the campaign to defend and advance ethnic studies. I'm sure you know all about it. I mean, your department's been very unique in terms of issuing a letter in support and solidarity with those students and faculty, but they're fighting for departmental status for race and resistance studies, launching Pacific Islander studies, enriching the Arab and Muslim ethnicities and diasporas program, hiring more black faculty and faculty of color, and that sort of thing. Now, of course, it's kind of significant to think about that struggle now in light of reflecting on 25 years of ethnic studies here, because San Francisco State holds an iconic status in the history of ethnic studies. That's where it begins in some respects. It's first wave ethnic studies. And that leads me to the second event that's sort of shaping, I shouldn't say framing, but really making me think about what I want to say. And that is the publication just last week of the Critical Ethnic Studies Reader, which was put together by a whole group of scholars who are part of the Critical Ethnic Studies Collective, Nada Elia, David Hernandez, Jody Kim, Shauna Redmond, Dylan Rodriguez, Savita C. Now, this book is an important intervention, and it just came out May 16th. So I haven't read all of it. I know some of the articles, but I read the introduction, which is very, very important intervention. And it begins with an assessment and a critique of the common narrative of ethnic studies. You know, the origins in the Third World Liberation Front and at SFSU. And as inspiring as that narrative is, they're suggesting, and as important as it is kind of identified with insurgent third world solidarity that is linking disparate histories of domination and resistance into what they call an ostensible totality of shared radical agency against empire, conquest, criminalization, and enslavement. At the same time, and this is what the authors argue, producing an ethnic studies framework that compartmentalizes, quote, human suffering into relatively discrete historical episodes and geographies, colonization, land displacement, chattel enslavement, and wars of conquest, apartheid and segregation, physical genocide, forced labor migration, and more, can undermine the project of critical ethnic studies. So these kinds of narratives, they argue, are inadequate for catalyzing or sustaining insurrection against a global social order that is so clearly apocalyptic for select targeted subjects, populations, and bodies. And this is especially true in the neoliberal university, which has no difficulty absorbing or incorporating what they call commodified and domesticated difference. And that goes back to liberal multiculturalism, often in the name of diversity, global citizens, that sort of thing. Now, they wonder how the radicalism of the Third World Liberation Front could be so easily co-opted by liberal multiculturalism. Now, when you look at those students who were waging this hunger strike, and if you look at what they're actually fighting for, they clearly weren't co-opted by liberal multiculturalism. You know, what they're making a demand for, I mean, the fact that you can have something called race and resistance studies is a kind of far cry from the framework of, you know, difference for the sake of difference, you know. And yet, it is true that even the most incorporated and most absorbed ethnic studies units, despite what seems to be a success, are still fighting for their lives. And the current struggle at San Francisco State is proof positive. So, and that's part of the argument, too, that, you know, these are programs that still have to demand funding, still are running by, on a shoestring budget and are really struggling. So these two developments give us food for thought. And what I want to do is offer my own reflections by revisiting the histories preceding, surrounding, and giving rise to second wave ethnic studies. Now, I still can't assume that everyone here knows first wave ethnic studies, if you know the story of the Third World Liberation Front and the establishment of the College of Ethnic Studies. I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but let me just give you like a 2-minute thumbnail sketch. It was a product of the longest student strike in history, as far as I know, 4 months. 90% of the students at San Francisco State shut down the school, and they had support from communities of color outside of campus. And if you look at most histories of first wave ethnic studies, that community relationship was essential for their survival and for their establishment. They demanded not just a program or a department, but a college, a third world college. They weren't just about diversity, in other words, having more black and brown faces, but they were about transforming the entire institution top to bottom. The Third World Liberation Front consisted of black, Latino, Native American, and Asian Pacific American student groups, at a school that in 1967-68 was 76% white. Okay, this is important to realize just demographically. You can't get 90% of students out unless the majority of white students also strike. So it means that they were for ethnic studies and other things. But keep that in mind. It was a range of issues, ultimately, that convinced students that a third world college could be a space for activism, a space for intellectual work that can address issues of racism, war, poverty, exploitation, and the exploitation of immigrant labor. So the initial mobilization wasn't strictly about ethnic studies. In fact, the first sit-ins in May 1967 were actually over the college making students' academic standing available to selective service. You know, in other words, trying to avoid the draft or fight the university from putting people on the list for the draft. And then add to that efforts to retain radical faculty of color, Juan Martinez in particular, a fight for a kind of open admissions for students of color, increasing financial aid, the removal of ROTC from campus. This was a range of issues that people were mobilizing around. And as a result of the strike, which ended in March of 69, they won a lot of the demands. Not all of them, but many of them. That struggle, in some ways, catalyzed others at Berkeley, Columbia, Cornell, some of the predominantly white universities across the country. So by 1971, programs/departments of ethnic studies, that includes black studies, Latino studies, Chicano studies, Asian American studies, were founded at over 500 universities, and at least one ethnic studies course was taught at 1,300 universities. And I should add, too, that ethnic studies, in its original inception, was a challenge to area studies. That is, you know, the state-sponsored, often U.S.-funded tools of U.S. empire. And instead, they identified with oppressed nationalities on a global scale that generated these programs and departments. I mean, it's important also to think of early ethnic studies as not national studies, but really global, transnational, international. And in fact, one of the most important examples of radical internationalism, or that streak in first wave ethnic studies, took place right here at UC San Diego, with the attempt to establish the Lumumba Zapata College in the early 1970s. And Jorge Mariscal, who's here, Brown Eyed Children of the Sun, his book is just genius, brilliant, talks about that history. The idea of the college, you know, which it didn't succeed, but it was a product of black and Chicano students and faculty mobilizing for black and Chicano studies. The frame that they developed, though it involved a lot of different coalitions and different ideological perspectives, was fundamentally anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist. And among the faculty leaders behind it was a very young Angela Davis and Keith Lowe. The latter drafted the proposal for what was first the college name for Patrice Lumumba. And again, it's interesting to think about this, what it means to be creating a, see you later, a Lumumba Zapata College, that is revolutionary figures outside of the United States linked to opposition to U.S. imperialism in at UC San Diego, at a place which, as you know, was started with a lot of military-industrial complex money. You know, John Jay Hopkins, head of General Dynamics, gave the UC system $1 million in 1953 to establish this campus. So in any case, the college did not materialize, but all across the country, there was a backlash against ethnic studies in the 70s and early 80s. If you just look at some of the articles about ethnic studies, and that, in fact, even to this day, but especially in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, they're seen as bastions of segregation, shoddy scholarship, unqualified professors. So by 1974, after this first wave of ethnic studies, there were only 200 such programs that remained. A lot of them were peeled back. 20 years later, in other words, the mid-1990s, at least 700 universities had ethnic studies programs or departments, and many of them included high-profile faculty at private institutions, just even as programs were being dismantled at public institutions. Now, how this happens, you go from this sort of low point in 1974 to this high point in 1994 is what I want to talk about today. And one of the ways to think about this is for us to rethink the 1980s. Now, when you think about the 1980s, you think about like Reagan and how terrible things were, and the fact that, you know, ketchup was reclassified as a vegetable. And, you know, this is like the story of the 1980s. It's a growing right-wing turn. It was like the consolidation of neoliberalism. But it was also a period of heightened, radical, anti-imperialist politics. Trust me, I was there. I saw it with my own eyes, you know? Not to say that experience is the same as evidence, but, you know. However, the other thing that the 1980s sort of reflected was the turn to what we now deem as colorblindness, colorblind ideology. And this evolved, again, out of the 1980s, out of the U.S. neoliberal turn, and it was also an era of racial backlash, not other kinds of backlash. Declarations, so you have racial backlash, another backlash I'm going to talk about in a second, but you also have declarations, especially by the 1980s among certain circles, that the civil rights movement's victorious. So the post-civil rights movement, the mythology of post-civil rights comes into being. Anyway, let me talk a little bit about this period. So the 80s are marked by retrenchment. And when I say backlash, we're talking about backlash against great society ideals, against remedies to achieve racial equality, shaped profoundly by neoliberal restructuring of global capital. And the results, of course, meant a decline in manufacturing, the capital flight, the flight of American corporations, not just to foreign lands, but to suburbs, the displacement of millions of workers across the country, cutbacks in welfare spending, the erosion of the social safety net, retreat from public education, especially integrated schools. You know, this is a period, 1978, with Proposition 13, which really undermined California public education. We could talk about that. And of course, Prop 13 was linked directly to the tax revolt. We talk about white working class resentment in this period, but much of that resentment was homeowners who are paying property taxes in a market where home values are booming and where unemployment is rising, precarity is becoming increasingly more dominant. And so for the middle class tax revolt, it is a kind of interesting response to try to maintain a particular kind of lifestyle as they're building capital through home ownership, but also reducing their contribution to state revenues. You have the opposition of affirmative action, we know that. You have the militarization of the border. In this period, it's heightened. Certainly, Jimmy Carter regime, in some ways, is responsible for certain waves of border militarization, but the Reagan administration, more than anything else, use the issue of an imminent border invasion to argue for increasing funding to militarize the border. And under Reagan, the U.S. increased its funding for Border Patrol by 130%. It expanded the number of detention centers and checkpoints. It increased the number of agents by 82%. And most importantly, once they passed, under Reagan, passed the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, which everyone thinks is this great, it's like, can we go back to Reagan? Like, we need immigration reform, but Reagan actually understood that. But what it did do was it cross-designated the Border Patrol as drug enforcement agents. And so it really became a heightened war on the border. And by the way, I'm not going to talk about it, but under Clinton, detention centers increased even more, you know. Later, 1994, this focus on the border, on anti-immigrant sentiment and violence, culminates with Proposition 187, which, of course, 3 years later is deemed unconstitutional, despite legal appeals by the governor. Now, this backlash was incredibly violent, and we have to remember that. The late Manning Marable, who was a dear friend and an amazing comrade, when he wrote How Capitalism Underdeveloped Black America, one of the things he pointed to was the level of violence in the 1980s and late 70s against people of color. And it was overwhelming, not just beatings and other kinds and police violence, but assassinations, vigilante violence. So, you know, in some respects, if you look at extralegal violence by the police, it heightens in the 80s. It's no accident that the 1980 opens up with a huge urban insurrection in Liberty City, Florida, around police killings and police brutality. The Ku Klux Klan's membership triples in Mississippi in 1980. By the way, I said 1980, not 1890. At least 12 African Americans were lynched. And at least 40 racially motivated murders occurred in cities as diverse as Buffalo, New York, Atlanta, Georgia, Mobile, Alabama. For those of you old enough to remember, Vernon Jordan was shot at. I mean, this is the head of the Urban League. He wasn't like any kind of radical. But that's the level of violence we're facing. The Klan, in 1979, November 3rd, assassinated 5 members of the Communist Workers' Party in Greensboro, North Carolina, in broad daylight on television, right? And none of those Klansmen, except for the civil trial, but none of them were convicted, you know, in the legal trial. And they did it at an anti-Klan rally at a black housing project, right? Between 1982 and 1989, the number of hate crimes reported annually in the U.S. grew threefold. And many of these incidents occurred on where? College campuses, right? We also have the horrific and fatal, brutal beating and murder of Vincent Chin in Detroit, which also was a source of mobilization. And having said all this, I still want to argue that what defined the 1980s wasn't the backlash or the violence or precarity or simply the numbers that are falling below the poverty line, but it was opposition. And we're talking about a period marked by intense domestic protests for jobs, international protests for peace and nuclear disarmament, because in the 1980s, nuclear war still is dangerous, but people are convinced that it's not. They say, oh, yeah, that's in the past. No, nuclear war was like on the verge. This is before the Cold War was over. But more importantly, you also had this hot war going on where U.S. intervention everywhere, Grenada, Lebanon, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Afghanistan, Honduras, Panama, Haiti, you can go on and on and on. Domestically, Reaganism, despite the fact that Reaganism sort of seemed to be dominant, there was a response. I mean, the National Black Independent Political Party was formed, the National Black United Front was formed in 1980, and many people were convinced that given the mayoral victories of Harold Washington, David Dinkins, and others, that a truly progressive, multiracial rainbow coalition politics can emerge. And this was like the center of Jesse Jackson's presidential campaign. But before his campaign, I just want to point to an event that happened in 1983 that we never talk about. And that is the 20th anniversary of the March on Washington. And it's interesting because it was conceived of not so much as an anniversary march. It wasn't like to commemorate anything. It was to protest the continuing denial of basic rights, the lack of jobs, and U.S. foreign policy in the U.S. And among its leaders were like members of Congressional Black Caucus and Coretta Scott King. And they had organized some 800 organizations in what was called a coalition of conscience to challenge Reaganism, to roll back civil rights legislation, Reaganism's rollback of civil rights legislation, and also to battle things that we don't always associate with the civil rights movement: unemployment, capital flight, demand nuclear disarmament, ending covert wars, cutting military spending. And they all mobilize under the banner of jobs, peace, and freedom. Now, this is beyond the scope of this talk, but I would make the argument, and I've made it before, that part of the problem with the mythology around post-civil rights is that it rewrites what the civil rights movement, the Black Freedom Movement, was actually intending to do. The demand of jobs, peace, and freedom was always at the center of that movement. Even the March on Washington 1963 was about jobs, peace, and freedom. And so it wasn't just about ending formal Jim Crow. And if you look at, say, the platform of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in, say, 1968, it was so radical. I mean, I don't want to go through the list, but, you know, these were the issues that were not issues of the past. These were issues of their present. And in 1983, these were the issues of the present. I mean, most people don't realize, like, you say, well, what was Coretta Scott King doing at the time? Well, she was one of the founders of the Full Employment Action Council in 1974, dedicated to ending unemployment and to full employment. Anyway, to go back to the march, so 1983, 200,000 people show up. That's about the same as showed up at the 1963 march. And again, they didn't go there to sort of remember King. They went there to fight. And out of that march and out of the negotiations and struggles, it's a long story, but basically out of that comes the resurrection of the Rainbow Coalition. The Rainbow Coalition as envisioned by Fred Hampton and the Black Panther Party in Chicago, picked up later by the Jackson campaign and by Jack O'Dell, who Jack O'Dell has a long, long history of struggle on the left. He was very close to Jackson, and he kind of, in some ways, sort of laid out the sort of revised Rainbow Coalition idea. Now, Jesse Jackson's campaigns of 84 and 88 is often ridiculed. People are very excited about Bernie Sanders, and I think people should be, you know. But when you think about this idea that his campaign is unprecedented, you basically ignore Jesse Jackson. You basically say Jackson's campaign doesn't exist because he may not have gotten as many votes, though he did win Michigan in the primary. His platform was actually far more progressive than even the Sanders campaign. So what were they pushing for? And by the way, this is not Jackson's platform. Jackson, because I was there too. You know, when I was a member of a left-wing organization, our job was to basically try to run the Rainbow Coalition locally, to take it over. And a lot of the platform issues that came up were came from progressive Asian American organizations, from environmentalists, from, you know, leftists, from Line of March to the Communist Workers Party. Everyone's coming up with these platform positions, and Jackson's like, okay, I'll take that. You know, I mean, that's how it worked. In any case, so this is what they were arguing, pushing for 20-25% cuts in military expenditures. I mean, could you imagine 25% cut? Billions reallocated to social programs, a bilateral nuclear freeze, unconditional opposition to U.S. military intervention in Central America, the Caribbean, the Middle East, Southern Africa, which includes Free Palestine, Cancellation of all strategic defense initiatives, which was this missile program that Reagan came up with. Legislation that would actually restrict capital flight across state and national lines. Federal assistance to small farmers to reduce their debt. And more and more. And of course, Jackson was for single-payer health care. Not, you know, ambivalent about it, but very clear about it. So consequently, for that generation of young activists and older activists in the mid-1980s, the generation that would go on and actually establish second wave ethnic studies programs as faculty, and some of the younger people who came out of that, people really did believe the time was right for revolution. And revolution was around the corner in the 1980s. It wasn't like the 80s was the dead point. The 80s was the most exciting point. The biggest demonstration before the Iraq War demonstrations in 2003 were the anti-nuclear war demonstrations in Central Park. So on college campuses, there were serious multiracial alliances being built, not to replace the ethnic nationalisms that brought people there, but to strengthen many of the different nationalist movements and to unite them. We also witnessed in the same period a right-wing appropriation and distortion of the language of civil rights. So the flip side is that post-civil rights discourse also produced a kind of appropriation of civil rights on the right, and that is civil rights was used to attack affirmative action, to attack any programs intended to remedy racial inequality. As we know, Prop 209 was called what? The Civil Rights Initiative. That's funny. So you got Ward Connerly and Clint Bolick of the Institute of Justice. You have the Campaign for a Colorblind America. You have Landmark Legal Foundation, the Center for New Black Leadership, all of them invoking this colorblind rhetoric and this idea of equal opportunity, and all doing this to dismantle anti-racist programs. And what we did not anticipate in fighting that battle was the kind of, I think, you know, more problematic and less sinister, if less sinister, liberal language of multiculturalism, which divides the world into the West and the rest of us. Fetishizes difference, but at the expense of ignoring power and how difference is produced. And in fact, the funny thing is that the way in which people were trying to theorize Eurocentrism in that period, it was a big struggle. Because on the one hand, Eurocentrism was being theorized in a very sophisticated way to understand the production of Europe, not as some kind of, you know, trans-historical entity, but as emerging as a particular entity or conception of the world's particular paradigm emerging in the Enlightenment as a way of actually excluding forms of opposition within Europe itself. That gets flipped into Eurocentrism becomes the way white people think, as if all white people think the same, as if somehow we can attach color to idea, right? And so in some respects, some of that stuff got not just confused, but picked up as well. Now, to be fair, and let me just say one more thing about liberal multiculturalism. Part of the discourse and part of the popularity with it, and it's still around, is that people were seen as products of heritage that had to be respected and understood. And so people were expressions of the things they do, what they eat, the clothes they wear, the language they speak, and that's basically it. So it's about difference without attention to power. In other words, existing ongoing structural racism and dispossession was rendered in the past. To be fair, though, ethnic studies was not the Trojan horse intended to introduce liberal multiculturalism. That is not true. I used to think that, but then I started looking at the issue, and actually there's a big struggle around ethnic studies' opposition to liberal multiculturalism. On the contrary, it was always fought for, and demands for it in the late 80s and early 90s were often responses to racist violence, to hostile climate on college campuses, and to the woeful lack of diversity among students and faculty. So if you look at like 1989, where, you know, Berkeley got its, no, Berkeley had had forms of ethnic studies before, but then in 89, there was student protest demanding the implementation of ethnic studies course requirements. And it's interesting because the student protests centered or were inspired by or prompted by, provoked by, racist incidents on campus. And a deal was brokered. I think the late Lawrence Levine was thrown into position of having to broker a deal between those who pushed for kind of more radical ethnic studies and those who wanted an American cultures rubric. And they came up with a course or a set of courses, and it still didn't pass overwhelmingly. There was all this opposition to it. And one of the articles I read in the popular press said something like, you know, faculty were concerned because they thought that there wasn't sufficient racism on campus to warrant such a... In other words, if there was more racism on campus, it would warrant an ethnic studies course. But there wasn't sufficient racism on campus to warrant an ethnic studies course. I thought that was funny. So, interestingly enough, most of the really vital ethnic studies programs, the ones that are with us now, were not established for the purposes of conflict resolution. They simply weren't. Certainly this program wasn't. It wasn't established for the purposes of building ethnic self-esteem. Students and some administrators might think that, but that wasn't the intention. It wasn't created for the purposes of promoting self-segregation. But as comparative and integrated models, right, the project was to examine race and racialization and the nature of power. In other words, how differences produced. And there was significant resistance to liberal multicultural models published everywhere. And I just kind of took stock, just going back and thinking about stuff. I went to my files. And like, if you're old as me, you actually have files, file folders, like file drawers with folders and paper inside of them. I never opened that stuff. So I just said, what was I saving? Like, what articles was I collecting around 1989, 1990, 91? And like some, I don't want to name all of them. Of course, I was reading George Lipsitz like crazy. I remember an article by Isan Nguyen Jr., Multiculturalism versus Hegemony, which came out in Massachusetts Review in 1991, and it was a really important intervention that described ethnic studies as the outgrowth of liberation struggles to, quote, redraw the boundaries, to affirm the autonomy of the internal colonies, the barrio, the reservation, inner cities, and recover the space for the exercise of popular democracy. And he talked about the gradual academizing of ethnic studies, the cult of ethnicity, based on a paradigm of European immigrant success models becoming orthodoxy. And this is his warning. He says, you know, this is this direction of sort of plotting, particularly the narrative of Asian Americans, onto a European success model just plays into the model minority myth. And he says we need to really pay attention to race and racialization and racism as causal factors in the making of U.S. political economy. And then he goes on to talk about ethnic studies revitalizing by challenging the orthodoxies of establishment intellectuals and state policies. And though he doesn't use the term neoliberal, in some respects he's saying that that ethnic studies ought to provide the tools for a critique of the neoliberal turn. It would seek to recapture the activist impulse presiding at its birth, mobilizing the agenda of popular memory by inscribing the history of people's struggles at the center of the discipline as critique and praxis, you know, he talks about. And there's so many people who are writing this. In fact, I think my recollection as more articles beginning to push back against the kind of language, the administration's language of liberal multiculturalism, and to sort of really attend to the question of power and the production of difference. So out of that struggle, you get these departments of ethnic studies. The University of Washington, Seattle launches its ethnic studies department in 1985 by consolidating existing programs in African American Studies, Asian American Chicano Studies. The University of Colorado Boulder created the Center for Studies of Ethnicity and Race. It's a kind of a long history going back to like 1990, but it develops over time. And when you think about like who was there, you know, like I remember, you know, Evelyn Hudahart, Manning Marable was there at the time. In fact, Manning Marable, a little secret, tried to recruit me to come to Colorado. Like when I was a very young scholar, my book wasn't even out. And I was like, wow, you know, but Colorado's cold, I can't go there. So I ended up going to Ann Arbor. I know, people go from Ann Arbor to Colorado for summer, for winter vacation. Right? Ward Churchill, I mean, there are people who are actually coming out of somewhat of a Marxist interpretation, an anti-imperialist interpretation, and this is ethnic studies. This is ethnic studies. It's not all of ethnic studies, but it was one of these spaces. And of course, in 1990, your program was founded. Founded as comparative from its inception, being about power. I won't reread yet again the founding statement, but I think it is interesting that the three processes are the three kind of critical processes that we're dealing with today. Mass incarceration, immigration, and forms of unfreedom, you know, slavery. And the fact that the statement really does talk about relationships in structural context of power. And just a side note, it's interesting too that the year before the program was founded, I was a professor at Emory University in history, in African American studies, and my book hadn't come out yet, but I had reached out to George Lipsitz. And George Lipsitz, who I had not met in person, became like my main mentor. Just talk about someone who devotes time to mentoring. I mean, Lipsitz gave me a model, which I can never live up to, by the way. I've failed. But he was a model in terms of reading work, giving feedback, but always, always, always asking the political questions about the work. You know, he was never interested in giving you advice like how to get tenure or like, you know, how to get something published or how to get, you know, to be persuasive. It was about where's the critique, where's the sharp critique. And that was the model for me. And so the fact that he comes here with Ramon Gutierrez, with Yen Espiritu, I mean, you're talking about like giants in the field who were completely uncompromising when it came to the critique of capital, right? That was always there. I think it's interesting that the opposition within the UCSD, in May of 1990, when you're like debating these questions before the Academic Senate, and all these people opposed it, one of the things that came up, which really speaks to the political context of the time, was the way in which the underclass debate shape political discourse surrounding ethnic studies relevance. I didn't talk about that at all, because that's the other thing that was big in the 1980s. That is that the argument that, it's not a new argument, but it took on new life in the 80s, and that is that the poor, the black poor in particular, are poor because of their cultural values, the kind of cultural poverty argument on steroids in many ways. So in some respects, that came up in the debate. So political scientist Sanford Lakoff, who may still be here, maybe dead, I don't know, maybe in the room, but he condemned the proposal as political mush and predicted, and this is the thing that's important to me, that students of color would not take courses in ethnic studies because it offered no skills. And by this, he meant marketable skills. By this, he meant human capital, like human value and human capital, that would increase income and raise, quote, them and their families out of poverty. So, of course, you got it. It's like the same thing that every student of color who ever went to public school ever heard, at least in my generation. Oh, you can't go to college. You should go to trade school. So for the students of color at UC San Diego, you should do the trade route rather than to be rather than take courses that actually might be intellectually stimulating and critical. And I thought that was really interesting, you know? But then you get the other thing that happened, too, 2 years after the founding of the program, which I think we have to remember had a huge impact, and that was the 1992 rebellion, the LA Rebellion. Because in some respects, the LA Rebellion helped disabuse some students and faculty that race is still very, you know, that race is the myth that race is no longer a factor, that ethnicity is about difference for the sake of difference. And so in some respects, there was a new push for ethnic studies after 1992. You know, you certainly see it, students at Berkeley protested confronting the police. They demanded a College of Ethnic Studies in the aftermath of the LA Rebellion. And then Columbia University, where I ended up in 2000, but in the 1990s, Columbia actually had some interesting protests. There was a hunger strike involving 14 students in 1996, fighting for ethnic studies or for a Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. You already had black studies there. And in some respects, they also adopted the San Diego model. That is the model of understanding and studying power. And their statement states that their approach focuses upon the locations and articulations of power as expressed in social formations. Okay, I'm going to skip. One other thing I should say about 1992, which is, and that is Chicano studies at UCLA. And I remember George Sanchez was on the faculty at the time, that Mecha had been fighting for a long time for a department of Chicano studies. You had a program, but the 1992 rebellion really was a big catalyst, because in January of 92, 4 months before the uprising, there was a proposal put together by faculty in Chicano studies for a department, which was kind of being rejected and tossed around, but eventually they prevailed. The last thing I want to kind of address is how, in some respects, depending on your perspective, the eruption of second wave ethnic studies in some ways laid the foundation for the Clinton neoliberal turn. And at first, as I was thinking about this last week, I had a totally different take on this. I was going to argue something different. I was going to argue that we were ill-prepared, that ethnic studies failed to prepare for the Democratic Leadership Council and Big Capital's sort of intensification of neoliberalism under Clinton. But actually, I began to look and think, that's not true. Some ethnic studies programs were. But I think sometimes what we end up doing is we end up getting confused by representations of ethnic studies without paying attention to what's actually being produced intellectually and what students coming out of those programs are doing. So if you look at Clinton, it's a period of the repeal of Glass-Steagall, it's a period of NAFTA, it's a period of the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996, which abolished AFDC, forced welfare recipients into low-wage labor markets without concern for the needs of children, cut $24 billion in food stamps. There's so much work that was being done in ethnic studies addressing the question of welfare reform. It's there. And this also coincides with a time when a lot of debates are talking about the relationship between gender and women's studies and ethnic studies, in part because of attending to welfare questions. In fact, one of the students that Dale mentioned, Eric Tang, was doing a lot of work at the time, specifically around Southeast Asian labor in New York City and the welfare state and the denial of welfare. In fact, all of my students were doing some work around these questions, which is exactly the point. You have, under Clinton, the Quality Housing and Work Responsibility Act of 1998, which authorized public housing agencies to exclude automatically and evict drug offenders and other felons. It's like a one-strike rule, basically. You have the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, which authorized doubling the U.S. Border Patrol agents over 5 years, which streamlined detention and deportation hearings, allowing for deportations without appeal to the courts. In other words, stripping so-called undocumented workers of habeas corpus. I mean, the draconian measures under Clinton are devastating, and you're about to get some more. Watch. We have to remember that. The Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, which spent more funds on the war on drugs and further expanded the prison system. So thinking about Clinton, and we're sort of mired in this fog of nostalgia, because, of course, the Clinton story is how robust the economy was, and everyone was, all boats were rising, and life was good, and all this other stuff. But think about what it means, because the 90s, and I'm going to make this argument and think I'm totally stupid, but the 90s were like the 80s. That is opposition. And it's like, really? And I'm telling the truth. I didn't realize until I kind of thought about it. The 90s was characterized, in fact, I think every decade is characterized by intense upsurge in opposition. Defeats, but opposition nonetheless. So you think about, like, what is the 90s? The 90s, you know, culminates with the battle for Seattle. You know, you have the U.S. Social Forum. You have immigrant rights demonstrations. I mean, just consider, Prop 187, you know, wasn't a defeat, per se. What did it do? It became a lightning rod for immigrant political activism. October 15th, 1994, I'll never forget, 70,000 people marched downtown L.A. against Prop 187. You couldn't have the uprisings of 2006 without that opposition. Right, the bus riders union emerges out of this strategy sentence. So what I'm about to do is give you a list of organizations that emerge specifically in opposition to Clinton. So you got the bus riders union, you got Power, you know, people organized working for employment rights. You got Soul, founded in 1996. You got Critical Resistance, formed in 1998. You got the Black Radical Congress, 1997-98. You got the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, 1998. You got the Los Angeles Community Action Network, which is very active right now in LA, fighting homelessness and police violence in 1999. The Miami Workers Center, which becomes a model for U.S. worker centers, formed in 1999. The Domestic Workers United, which is now the Alliance, founded in 2000. So a lot of these organizations ultimately come out of opposition to Clintonism. They weren't blinded by that. And who are those people? A lot of those same young activists came out of ethnic studies. They may not have been ethnic studies majors, but they came out of colleges and programs in which that's where they learned the relationship between race and capital, gender and capital, you know, between urban space and policing and violence. And it's out of that, I would argue, that those people emerging in as they become older, who end up laying the foundations for much of the organizing around Occupy or Black Lives Matter, the Dreamers, We Charge Genocide, Dream Defenders, Black Youth Project. A lot of the advisors of some of these youth organizations are people who came out of ethnic studies, and I can name them. The Community Rights Campaign in LA. So I think that, just sort of conclude, I don't really have a conclusion here, but just to say a few words about this, these, I think, are the descendants of the radical insurgency that formed the left wing of second wave ethnic studies. The sort of scholars and activists that you've all been producing here at UCSD, I think, for a quarter of a century, and recruiting all these radical professors here who are just, I'm so envious of, because they're just amazing, amazing scholars. And for a quarter of a century, who understand that the issues at stake fall outside of the kind of legal, civil, and constitutional rights, and are better understood in terms of transitional demands, ultimately revolutionary demands. Transitional meaning like the right to housing, which of course San Diego's been a central place for organizing around this, education, a living wage, even talking about the social wage, immigrant rights, reproductive rights, struggles around sexuality and sexual identity, ending the carceral state, decolonization, and the restoration of the commons. And I think just a final word, because part of what got me thinking about all these things is not just the ongoing struggles, not just the critical reassessment of ethnic studies in light of the publication of this new reader, or in light of what we can call third wave ethnic studies, that is critical ethnic studies. It's not just that, but it's something that's been frustrating me a little bit, and now I'm going to do confessional, is that I'm just getting old, I know that, but there's a tendency among some of the younger student activists I'm dealing with, you know, maybe just UCLA, who really are buying into a certain kind of identity politics that is, you know, not based on the way we thought about, the way ethnic studies thought about identity in relationship to movement, but instead identity is being fixed and they can't be changed. And so I got students saying, like, there's certain things I'm not going to read because it was written by a white person, or, you know, certain things I'm not going to read because, you know, or I'm not going to think about certain things. And I'm not saying that's the majority, but if that's the tendency, that actually goes against the original impulse of ethnic studies in all three waves. Because if ethnic studies is anything, it is, as Cedric Robinson puts it in terms of black studies, it is a critique of Western civilization. You know, it is an interrogation of all the structures of oppression that affect all of us. And if it's liberatory, it's not liberatory for a few, but it's liberatory for all. It's like, you know, Curtis was saying, like Wayne Yang says, you know, it's a study of everything that matters. Which means if that's true, if everything that matters, that means that there's nothing off limits. There's not a single issue or reading or text or struggle that's off limits. One of the most important struggles that a lot of us were involved in, I'll just leave you with this thought, in the 1980s, it wasn't, I mean, we're all involved in the anti-apartheid movement, but as a black person, the anti-apartheid movement was important, it was international, but it was the sanctuary movement. You can't be in LA and not be involved in the sanctuary movement, which is about providing sanctuary for people who are fleeing death squads in Central America. And that was not off limits. And that wasn't about people of color, that was about state violence, right? So when we can have that kind of critique, that restores back to, I think, the power of first, second, and third world, third wave ethnic studies. And with that, I'll stop and we'll have a conversation. Thank you.
There was kind of a specter haunting your talk, and you mentioned it because you talked about the left wing of ES, and you talked about worker centers, and you talked about people who don't want to read things written by white people. So I want to ask you, because that world that we grew up in was, you know, divided in that way, for the people whose introduction to ethnic studies comes in the current moment and who learn through the critical route, what role do we propose for that old German social scientist and his world that has disappeared?
Right. That's an excellent question. And you know what? I'm glad that you talked about the specter haunting us. I mean, besides the fact that it's, you know, from the Communist Manifesto, but also because there's another specter that I didn't address at all. And I didn't occlude it for on purpose. It wasn't like it deliberate, but and that is the continuing presence of a very intense nationalism that actually was not going in the path that I'm suggesting, not always going in the path I'm suggesting. And so I'm not even saying that this is a generation, the first generation to adopt a kind of an identity politics based on a reading of skin or perception. In fact, it's always been there. And at Long Beach State, the irony was, you know, my teachers, I got my degree in history in black studies. My minor was black studies, but on the black studies side, who was my teachers? Maulana Karenga, Amin Ra. I mean, I was learning about like a real strict racial politics on the one hand, and I had two Trotskyites in the history department who taught me. So I'm like dealing with both of this stuff, right? So that's real. But to your question about where does that incredibly brilliant German social scientist, activist, Charles Marx, and his friend Freddie Engels fit, I'm always trying to get people to read Marx and take Marx seriously. I'm also at the point now where I'm, after all these years, and we just had a panel discussion yesterday, really a tribute to Cedric Robinson. We just published, if you haven't seen it yet, we reprinted The Terms of Order, which was his first book, published in 1980, and is a new version with a beautiful introduction by Erica Edwards. Just genius. It's just a massive undertaking. And Cedric was really my first, George Lipsitz comes next, but before George, Cedric was like my teacher. And I had to come to terms with the fact that his work was all about a critique of Marxism, a critique. I have my students read Black Marxism and they don't get it always. They actually don't realize that it's a devastating critique of Marxism. The Terms of Order is a devastating critique of Marxism. And the only way he could critique Marxism is by reading and understanding and getting down to what are the limitations of say, the fiction of leadership or the fiction of order. What are the limitations of understanding capitalism and not attending to nation and race, and that race and nation, racialism precedes the formation of capitalism. So he has this brilliant critique of Marxism, which I had to come to. Grace Lee Boggs, who was my other teacher, she had a critique of Marxism. And so I have a very sharp critique of Marxism now, despite the fact people identify me as a Marxist. But that critique of Marxism is based on both Grace Lee Boggs and Cedric Robinson's deep understanding of what you can take. So there's no possible way that anyone could begin with the critique of Marxism without reading Marx. That's where you begin. And you take from that both the power of his imagination in terms of moving from a kind of Hegelian idealism to historical materialism, but then realize the limits of materialism, right? When we're talking about people who are trying to maintain the ontological reality, ontological totality, I should say. So in some respects, I think there's a lot we can gain from that, and I will continue to teach Marx and continue to sort of wrestle. And that includes teaching Rosa Luxemburg, teaching, all the German social democrats, Karl Kautsky, and teaching, Lenin. But then it means teaching Amilcar Cabral and, teaching Barbara Smith and Angela Davis and teaching, everybody you can teach to move in that direction. Because the one great thing about all ways of ethnic studies is that they all have their limits. And that's exciting because it means that the work's not over. It means that we have a lot more work to do to figure out, how do we move toward a kind of liberatory possibility when certain forms of liberation produce enclosure for other people. Like, how do we move Bob? And that's a very difficult question. So thank you for that. Someone else? Yes.
One of the most robust areas of ethnic studies is different iterations of cultural studies. And in the late 90s, 2000s, you in some ways became a kind of lightning rod for different components of cultural studies. I'm thinking of the famous takedown piece by Adolf Reed, I don't want to get into the intricacies of that necessarily. But with your work from Race Rebels, Yo Mama's mm-hmm. Dysfunctional, you very much emphasize the cultural realm as a vital site of articulating both the political economy issues with cultural representation and expression. I know that wasn't the scope or focus of your talk today, but I would love to hear you wax a little bit about, say, you know, one of the areas that coincides with that resistance is hip hop. Like,
right,
I mean,
right.
In the era that you're charting, and I maybe even kind of telescope to the cultural realm today as a site of resistance.
Right. I think. Well, thank you for that. Yeah, that Adolf Reed piece was a beat down piece. Well, I got beat down.
Yeah, you did.
And got beat down totally unfairly, because if you actually read what he says in The Village Voice, the only critique he has of my work is not even the work itself, but my acknowledgments. No, go back and look at it. Yeah, because I said shout outs, right? So you can't do that because, you know, you're basically performing to white people. I said, of course. But at the same time, Adolf's work is so important. And he actually anticipated a lot of critiques early on when he talks about black particularity reconsidered. It's a piece that he wrote, I think, in 1979. And he has been very good about basically being attentive to class. And I want to begin with Adolf Reed because in some ways the question of cultural studies was oftentimes framed as in opposition to class, to the study of class, or a retreat from Marxist analysis. You know, now where do we get our cultural studies from? We got it from Stuart Hall. We got it from the Birmingham, Center for Cultural Studies, and then the U.S. version of that. So in some respects, it was about studying class, almost an intense study of class. But then where did Birmingham cultural studies come from? Where did it come from? Well, it certainly came from some of the uprisings in Brixton and elsewhere where you have anthropologists and social scientists who are activists but trying to figure out, what is the relationship between racism, British nationality and belonging, and state violence, and class, because class was at the center of much of what they were doing, on the one hand. On the other hand, the other place they got some of those ideas from, we don't always pay attention to it, is from E.P. Thompson. So E.P. Thompson's famous preface to the, Making the English Working Class is about class, about classist culture. It's about saying that class is more than just a structural relationship to capital, but it is about class being made, created, and that's a cultural process. So it's like, we gotta go back to E.P. Thompson for me to know like how I came to cultural studies. E.P. Thompson has as much to do with it as Stuart Hall for me, because I came into this academic world writing about the working class. That was my thing. I came into the academic world, basically as a communist, and my students know this, as a communist who was interested in class struggle, who had very little friendly relationships with the black bourgeoisie. In fact, that was the people who used to get mad at me because I had nothing good to say about bourgeois black people. I was attacking them all the time. You're too harsh on them. And I had to, I'm less harsh now. Maybe because I am one. Who knows? I mean, we'll see. But in the end, cultural studies was a revelation for me to try to understand how not just race, but class is lived as a modality. That class is not something that that is chosen for us, but something that we make in terms of solidarities. So it's about making solidarities. Because it's one thing, and it just goes back to Marx. Marx made that distinction between a class for itself and a class in itself. A class for itself is the class that actually can decide that they are a class, and that as a class, they can move forward in solidarity. So that was the magic and beauty of cultural studies for me. When Jan Radway and I started this series at Columbia University Press, the idea behind it was to try to publish books that focus on cultural production and not consumption. Because part of the turn, the sort of the linguistic turn or the, was about turning towards semiotics and other ways of reading cultural text? How do we read a text? How do we understand a text? And we kept thinking, okay, well, how do we understand people making class identities or making racial identities? So the whole series was about that. And we ended up publishing books like Joe Austin's book, Taking the Train, and you know, stuff about graffiti and just a whole range of different books, really, really, really terrific series. But, you know, in some respects, I ended up being on the outside of some of the mainstream cultural studies movements at the time, because as it moved more and more towards reading texts, I became less interested in that, because it didn't do much for me in terms of understanding working class history. My big foray, of course, was writing about hip-hop, which, you know, people still blame me. And it was when in Race Rebels, I have the chapter on gangster rap, and I did a couple other things for that, which was never my intention. But even in that chapter, I was more interested in the creation of racialized and class identities. What does it mean for people to adopt the N-word as a way to refer to not just masculinity, but class station, you know, as well as, you know, race. So that's the kind of stuff that I think is, and I still think that cultural studies has so much to offer to this day. It's not like a dead field, it's very much an alive field. And it's one of the fields that, in which interdisciplinarity is just foundational. You know, you have to do that. But I don't know if that answers the question, but that's, thinking about that reminds me of that that period. So,
oftentimes in the media, we keep hearing that the middle class is suffering. And I'm always thinking, well, if the middle class is suffering, what is happening to working classes? And I wanted to know, why do you think that politicians and, of course, those steering this media, why does there continue to be this emphasis pretty much a great deal on the middle class?
That's a good question. I mean, Dave Roediger is writing a book on the middle class, actually, and I haven't read any parts of it. I know it's going to be really, really smart. But one of the things that a lot of us have battled over the years is, you know, all these designations are produced. So, and they're fictions in some respects. They're fictions. I mean, middle class is a certain kind of fiction, because it allows you to, it allows for the creation of an identity that's not tied to wealth or production, specifically production. You know, because middle class means that you're sort of floating. Middle class also is a cultural designation. Middle class means respectability. You know, like, you don't say, like, those are middle class people in prison. You know, no one ever says that. It's about respectability. It's a value judgment in some respects. Middle class evokes all these different elements, like home ownership, for example. And home ownership is tied to questions of responsibility. And so if you talk about, I want to defend the middle class, it's a way to generate support from voters and from others who don't see themselves as working class. Working class, at one point, and again, I don't want to be romantic, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago, maybe 100 years ago, was not an epithet. You know, working class is framed as being below middle class. But when you think about it, what we call middle class, for the most part, is working class, for the most part. It just is one of these categories that just sweeps up everybody. I mean, most of the people, when you think about, like, what does it mean to own a home in a place like Detroit? And I don't mean Detroit in 2016. I mean Detroit in 1966. It meant that you most likely were working an auto plant. You most likely, you know, made a very good salary. You most likely were involved in civic organizations and all the stuff that we think of as working class. But people still identify themselves as working class for the most part. So it's a way of masking the exploitative relationships between, like, labor and capital on one hand, but it also is a way of generating solidarity. And this is a solidarity that's not always the most productive one, because it's a solidarity that's often based on the idea that, and this comes back to the kind of race and gender question, that the social wage, you know what I mean by social wage, that is, in a social democracy, that part of the accumulation of revenue that would go to support, you know, the elderly, the poor, so that people are not poor. I mean, to provide supports for people so that there's no poverty, but that everyone actually has a kind of floor. We don't have a social wage anymore, not much of it. So the idea of the social wage becomes, Nancy Fraser talks about this, a kind of antisocial wage, because everyone who receives from the government the social wage is seen as a drain. Black women, in particular, receive, if they receive any support in the form of transfer payments, in the form of, say, food stamps. I mean, in countries where the social wage is just sort of natural, like in South Africa, for example, as much inequality as there is in South Africa, when they have their meetings about the social wage, people in government applaud. They say, you know, we raise the minimum wage, we raise the amount of support for the elderly, we raise the amount of subsidies for poor farmers. This is all, you know, part of the social wage. So, in some respects, if part of the making of the middle class is that it is a class or a category based on solidarity of not being dependent. Of not being dependent. Now, are they dependent? Of course they're dependent. How did the middle class come about? What kind of subsidies they get from the state? How much money, federal money, went into supporting, you know, home loans and highways and byways, all the stuff that George Lipsitz talks about in The Possessive Investment of Whiteness, all that stuff. We know they're dependent. I mean, everyone is interdependent. But the difference is the kinds of supports that we should think of as humane as part of social wage are now considered to be given to the other people. So you can't be middle class and receive a welfare payment. You can't be middle class and receive a subsidy. You can't be middle class, and unless the subsidy is something that's hidden, that's not seen as an entitlement. So part of the making of the middle class identity is about not having entitlements, about being independent and autonomous, and about saying, because of this, I shouldn't have to pay taxes. So the tax revolt of the 1970s, a lot of that's about a middle class identity and solidarity around refusing to give, to contribute to revenue despite the fact that you benefit from that revenue. Right? So the idea of the middle class itself is very problematic. It does certain political work. And that's why politicians could talk about, yep, you know, we got to do something about raising middle class. You know, and they're not going to say, you know, open the prisons. Social justice issues in the United States has never been a majority project. Ever. There's never been a generation that with the majority of the people actually were like pushing for social justice. I mean, even in the period of the kind of romantic 1960s.
Or even 1930s
period. Even 1930s too. I mean, in some respects, what did the 1930s produce? It produced some really amazing militant movements, no question about that. I think every generation did. The 1930s also had a strong, vibrant labor movement. But even the labor movement was divided. You have an AFL-CIO that's saying, you know, the state can only go so far. An AFL, rather, saying the state can only go so far, and that certain jobs should be protected and certain skills should be closed off. Whereas the CIO in the early period was saying, you know, well, we need to organize the unorganized. We need to have industrial labor. In other words, for even the generation of the 30s, you have people who are still pushing the idea of, let's say, the iconic male wage earner who is white, right? Social justice doesn't extend to beyond that class. I mean, the fact that New Deal legislation, which people sort of, you know, celebrate all the time, also was kind of racially engendered structure, you know, in a certain kind of way. The idea of AFDC in its early forms was about families with dependent children, with the assumption that male wage earners should be either absent or be so broken down that they, you know, that they shouldn't get any kind of support. So the idea of a massive social wage for everyone has never been the majority of the U.S.'s position. In other words, the majority of people. I mean, so I think it's true that certain generations tend to be shaped by certain political possibilities, and the depth of the 1930s produced certain possibilities, but it also produced fascism, you know? And fascism was a way in which of thinking about the state as a racial state. And that fascism, you know, is not limited to Germany and Italy and Spain or, you know, Portugal. It was in the United States as well. It wasn't a fascist state. But the idea that you have fascist movements erupting as responses to crisis.
I really appreciate your recent publication in the, is it the Boston Globe?
Oh, Boston Review, right.
Yeah.
The Boston Globe wouldn't run that.
Okay, the Boston Review. And I especially appreciate your critique of the kind of psychologizing of structural racism and the bureaucratization of diversity on university campuses. And I'm wondering if you've seen any successful student faculty movements to subvert this in recent times?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. To be fair, the bureaucratization diversity, that's a really big issue, especially in that piece. And at the same time, I didn't want to give the impression that I didn't want to conflate the what you call the psychologizing of structural racism with the actual very real mental health issues that not just this generation, but many generations of the past have dealt with. So in other words, I'm saying that they're not the same thing, and the latter is really an urgent issue, and which is why I think supporting more resources for mental health and for supports for students is extremely important part. And so people kind of misread that. They think that I gotten so many emails from people saying, you know, what do you have against, you know, trauma? I said, no one likes trauma. I said, but the idea of a narrative in which you can reduce all of African American history or all of history of people of color to trauma, which of course you're getting at. I'm just clarifying for the people about to beat me up. So that's different. But in terms of success, I actually think that the same student, that if you cut across the sort of whole range of student struggles that have taken place since 2015, there are probably a lot of very successful efforts on the part of students to make certain demands. So if you look at, for example, University of North Carolina Chapel Hill demands, their demands are extraordinary in terms of the way in which they don't go for the liberal multicultural okey-doke at all. They understand the university's complicity in the reproduction of structural racism, both on and off campus, of class oppression, of, you know, gender marginalization and exploitation. They got it straight. But that partnership, it's the partnership part, requires an administration willing to go there. And that I've never seen. So the thing is, the students, I think, are right. It's the administration's, the administration tends to do three things. I saw this at UCLA. One, the former committee to look into it. Two, they will hire a 6 to 7 figure czar, right? Some provost for diversity, blah, 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 right? Who then will form a committee. And then the third thing would be, and this goes back to like the history of, full circle to what I was talking about, to sort of say, okay, it's up to the faculty to come up with solutions. And the easiest solution they come up with is more courses and a few diverse faculty here and there, but no structural changes in what we do in pedagogy. No relationship to the communities that university contributes to their suffering. you know? One of the amazing things about the student movements, and I think this is tied together, was that almost all the demands on the major universities, these ones I'm familiar with, included some form of divestment, whether it's divestment from occupied territory, divestment from coal, divestment from prisons. What that means is they're saying that the university is complicit in the way the world looks. And unless you change the curriculum to basically allow students and faculty together, not in a leadership position of faculty, but together to basically tackle the conditions of the world and struggle with them, not for grades, not for, you know, advancement, that we'll never be able to advance a kind of radical pedagogy that will actually give people a sense of self-worth, that will actually push back against the kind of trauma that people experience all the time. We need to change the whole structure. And the one thing that I got pushback on in that article, and I'm always sort of rethinking it, is whether or not there's hope for the university. People got mad at me because, like, there's no hope. I'm like, there's no hope. Because I was sort of following Fred Moten and Stefano Harney's position in their book, The Undercommons, which I really suggest you can get for free. You can download it. And I don't know yet. I don't know the answer. But if there is hope, the hope is in doing two things. One, maintaining the undercommons. That is a space in which students and faculty who are willing, but especially students, could come together on your own, read together, struggle together without having anyone telling you what to do, right? And find the places where you believe injustice exists and you attack it on your own without anyone telling you what to do. You don't need a grant for that. You don't need credit for that. You don't need a course. That's one thing. That is self-study. And self-study is not the same as, you know, when I say self-study is not study the self, and nor is it like self-care, because self-care is a neoliberal move. You want mutual care. You want collective care. You don't want self-care, meaning that you only care for yourself. You know, you want care that's about each other. But if you do that intellectually, you will, just our own sort of survival as people will be advanced, number one. Number two, the second thing to do is to take the culture of the undercommons, and that is use the tools of this machine to try to bring down the worst elements of it, to try to work, to recognize where oppression and exploitation exists on your campus, whether it's people who clean your dorms or people who, you know, are doing the lawns and stuff like that, and build solidarity with working people. Build with them. Learn from them. Understand that you know, just because you're a college student doesn't mean that you know better than the people who are, like, cleaning your rooms, and that you could learn from them, right? That requires a complete rethinking of what the space is. It means that there's no more invisible labor. No one's invisible. Everyone's visible. Everyone's there, you know? And I have to give credit. I mean, UC San Diego has this great, amazing history. I remember Danny had come to my class when it was at USC, and gave a talk, and part of his talk was about what was happening at San Diego. It was 2010, right? Those struggles. And it was amazing. I mean, students were so far advanced. I have no critique of the students. You know, they're so far advanced. They know what to do, but the structure doesn't always allow it. And if the structure doesn't allow it, then the structure needs to come down. You know? So, anyway, with that.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.